This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We will visit with the incomparable Percy Sledge. He recorded When a Man Loves a Woman in 1966. That song has been named one of the 100 greatest of all time by Rolling Stone magazine. Also, Congressman Bob Livingston, man who was within a whisker of becoming Speaker of the House 15 years ago. He's with us, still quite active in Washington, D.C. And former Pentecostal pastor Jerry DeWitt. He's now espousing atheism and has written a book about it. He's from DeRidder. Hope After Faith is his book, An Ex-Pastor's Journey from Belief to Atheism. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Warming up is Percy Sledge, the incomparable singer, member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's next, but we have a political Hall of Famer to start, Robert Bob Livingston, former U.S. Congressman. He represented Louisiana on Capitol Hill for 22 years in the United States House of Representatives and became right at the top of the ladder as far as influence in the United States House, came within a whisker of being the Speaker of the House. Good morning, Congressman Livingston.
Good morning, Jim. It's good to be back with you.
Well, it's 14 years now since you were a member of the House of Representatives, and some of the same issues are permeating, particularly the debt and the deficit. That's one of your passions. What's going on?
Well, there's an organization called Fix the Debt that is primarily focused on trying to get this horrible debt of the United States under control. They're doing a great job. They're spreading the word and getting 150,000 letters sent to members of Congress. They've got 350,000 signatures on their citizens' petition to fix the debt. And they're trying to get more and more people interested in it. Jim, when I left Congress 14 years ago, the aggregate debt for the 210 or so years of the history of the country was $5 trillion. Here we are 14 years later, and it's almost $17 trillion. The last 14 years, Republicans and Democrats have just totally pulled out the stopper and spent there was no tomorrow. And unfortunately, tomorrow is coming. And Louisiana and the entire nation are going to suffer. You know, we're right now in the worst recovery of any recession that we've had practically in the history of the country, certainly in the last 60, 70 years since the Great Depression. And it's just, the country is just slow to come back because we've borrowed so much to finance, whether it's been wars or social programs or whatever, and we've just depleted ourselves, and now interest rates, fortunately, because of our Federal Reserve, have been low for the last few years, but that's about to end. And once interest rates start going up, small businesses, big businesses, families, and the government itself will find it very, very difficult to finance their activities.
Well, when you left Congress 14 years ago, Bob Livingston, we as a country were on the road to a surplus in the budget. Something
That's
went
right.
terribly awry. Who's to blame? Is it a joint blame, or do you point a finger at one specific party?
No, actually, I think both parties share the blame in this regard because, you're absolutely right. When we left, President Clinton was still in office, and he wanted to spend more, and we in the Republican Congress held him back. And as a result, the fact is that, as you've just pointed out, the country did enjoy about two or three years of surplus. But then 9/11 hit, and that wasn't anybody's fault except the terrorists abroad. But we started beefing up our defenses. We went to war in Afghanistan and Iraq. They took the expense of the war during the Bush administration off budget. which was a mistake. I mean, they should have figured we've got to pay for it. We've had Katrina. We've had a lot of natural disasters that we just haven't paid for. And then we've just increased the level of programs that help people, all for good intentions, but the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and we've just lost track of our ability to control the budget.
When I was a
chairman of the Appropriations Committee, we concentrated on that, and we were determined to cut back.
Many of the members of Congress on the GOP side, congressmen, have taken this pledge with Grover Norquist not to vote for any new taxes. Is that an impediment in addressing the budget and the debt and the deficit?
Well, if you're going to reach a deal, it's got to be bipartisan. And, you know, if you're certainly the idea of cutting taxes is a good one these days because taxes are too high. However, you may want to cut taxes here and raise them there. And when you sign those kinds of pledges, you can get half of the equation. You can cut here, but you can't raise there. And as a result, you can't get a deal. And that's where we are in Congress today. Congress is at an impasse. The Republicans and Democrats are not getting along. The House and Senate don't get along. And the White House doesn't get along with the entire Congress. So, you know, it helps to be able to work with the other side and reach a compromise that solves our problems. And we don't seem to be in that fashion these days, and it bothers me greatly because I think it's affecting the future of this nation.
Bob Livingston, who represented Louisiana's 1st District for 22 years, from 77 to 99, and is now a prominent lobbyist on Capitol Hill. You've done very well, as you did in Congress. You've done very well as a lobbyist. There are those who think that members of Congress should not become lobbyists. What do you say to those who have that sentiment?
Well, I didn't know that we were such a nation that turned its back on its own constitution. I mean, our First Amendment gives us the right of free speech and right of free religion. And, you know, increasingly people coming up with ideas to restrict other people from making a living or from doing what in years past has been absolutely legal. The fact is, if when we talk about lobbying, and I know it's an unpopular term, but nobody quarrels with hiring a lawyer to go to court because the lawyer understands the court processes, the rules of procedure. Well, nobody understands the legislative process better than somebody who's been in it for 22 years as I have. And people hire me because I understand the process and get things done. Look, if people act illegally or unethically, they're going to go to jail or should go to jail. Nobody's quarreling with that. But anybody has the right to petition their representative, and if they don't know how or don't have the time, or then they can always, just as they can hire a lawyer, they can hire a lobbyist to go to Congress and try to get things done. And I think one of the big restrictions, one of the big problems the country is having, is that we're trying to restrict that. We're trying to keep people from expressing themselves to their representatives. We ought to be encouraging more free speech, and that's what I'm just kind of an agent for free speech.
Do you have regrets that you didn't become speaker? And when I say you came within a whisker, I'm not exaggerating.
Jim, I don't think I have any regrets from a personal point of view. Sure, it would have been nice, but I do have regrets from the standpoint of people of Louisiana and the nation. I think I would have done a better job than the people that succeeded me. And from that vantage point, I guess I have to say yes.
What do you think of yesterday's Supreme Court decision about the Voting Rights Act?
I just talked to Senator Tim Scott not more than an hour ago. He's the African-American senator from South Carolina, which in years past been one of the toughest states in the union with regard to civil rights. That was many years past. And he was saying, you know, times change, and South Carolina's changed, and Louisiana's changed, and Mississippi's changed. We've got more African-Americans elected in the South than perhaps any other part of the country. We've got an African-American president of the United States, an African-American attorney general. We've had African-American secretaries of state. times have changed. And what the Supreme Court simply did was recognize that in 50 years, some states have changed. If there are still some areas that are repressing minorities from and trying to keep them from voting, then Congress can go back to the table according to the ruling and target those specific areas. But you just can't bear a grudge for what happened 50 years ago because the circumstances and the attitudes of the people are totally different today than they were back then. And so I think it was a good ruling.
Dan downtown, please be brief. You're on with Congressman Bob Livingston.
Yes, so, Mr. Livingston, does the free speech of rich corporate interests with lobbyists and their access to the levers of power push aside the free speech of the poor who can't afford to hire a lobbyist?
Actually, you're absolutely and 100% wrong. The poor have so many lobbyists in this town that they outnumber. In fact, the social programs have grown exponentially in recent years. This government is doing more for the poor than it ever did in the history of the nation. And I would venture to say that the poor have eloquent spokesmen, bright and capable spokesmen, and that the trouble is we've kind of lost the degree of common sense in understanding we can only do so much and we can't afford everything. We can't solve every problem in the world. So, I disagree with you, sir.
Why do you think Louisiana's gone solidly red in its politics, Congressman? Much of this happening since you left public office.
I think whether you're talking about national defense and security of the nation, you're talking about fiscal responsibility, you're talking about fundamental conservative religious values. The South has always been a conservative place. We talked about civil rights, and the South was wrong in civil rights up until the Civil Rights Act was passed in the early 60s. But the South has changed since then on that, but they haven't changed their fundamental respect for family values and their God-fearing attitude about how the country should be run and the respect for national defense and their patriotic fervor. But the Democrat Party has kind of gone off the other way. It has drifted to the left so far that even Senator Gillery, I think it was Opelousas, woke up and said, "Wait a minute, I'm no longer part of the Democratic Party," and he just switched to Republican as the first African American state senator of modern times to do that. I welcome him to the party. I think it's great, and I thought his statement was one of the most eloquent I've ever heard.
Brandon asks, "What your perception of the man who succeeded you in the U.S. House, David Vitter?"
Well, Senator Vitter is an outstanding senator. I mean, I always say I was succeeded by two Rhodes Scholars. One is the United States Senator, and one is the governor of the state of Louisiana. And both of them have made me extremely proud. They've both done very, very well. David Vitter is an excellent senator. And then after he got elected to the Senate, of course, Bobby was there and then got elected governor. And then now Steve Scalise is the current holder of my old seat, and he's outstanding as well. He's a combative guy who appreciates the values that are held dear by Louisianans, and he is now the leader of the conservatives in the Congress.
Well, Congressman, it's always a pleasure. Bob Livingston, by the way, for those who don't know, is a descendant of Robert Livingston, the elder brother of Philip Livingston, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and one of the congressman's ancestors was author of the poem The Night Before Christmas, Henry Livingston. Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you, Jim. You're very nice to have me.
Always a pleasure. Take care. We'll be back with Percy Sledge. Rolling Stone says, "When a man loves a woman," recorded 47 years ago, "is the 54th greatest song in the history of mankind and music." We'll be back with Percy Sledge after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. And joining us is the incomparable Percy Sledge, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. He recorded When a Man Loves a Woman in 1966 and has had numerous hits since then, but this is the signature song for this man who calls Baton Rouge home. Good morning, Percy Sledge.
Well, good morning, Jim. It was a pleasure.
It's good to hear your voice. 297-5633 is your number outside the area, 877-217-5757. JC, let's give a listen to this song from the great Percy Sledge. Do you remember where you recorded it, Percy?
Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
Muscle Shoals, Alabama. You're a native of Alabama.
Yeah, I was born in a little town called Leeton, Alabama, about 8 miles from Muscle Shoals.
Released April 16th, 1966. Recorded February 17th, 1966. Did you know you had something exceptional?
No, because, see, this was my first record, and I didn't know anything about recording at that time, and I didn't even realize what I had. Of course, Quinn Ivey, my producer, and all the musicians had experienced at it because they'd been recording for some years. And they told me, said, Percy, man, you're really going to cause a monster. I didn't even realize it. You know?
What a monster. It has been recorded by many others, including Marvin Gaye and Jerry Butler, Art Garfunkel, Otis Redding. Michael Bolton had a hit with it in 1991, and it was even recorded by the country singer Barbara Mandrell, When a Man Loves a Woman. Listed, as I said, number 54 all-time in the list of Rolling Stone's 500 greatest songs in history.
Yeah, it was still in the top 10 around the world, one of the top 10 played records in the world.
Who wrote it?
I did. And I gave it away. But I gave it to my bass player and my keyboard player, Lewis and Wright.
Calvin Lewis and Andrew Wright. So when did you write it, Percy?
I wrote it, we recorded in April. And I put I had the melody in my mind for years. When I used to work, pick and chop cotton in the fields, when I feel sad, I'd always sing this melody and whatever I wanted to sing about or say, you know. And I never in my life thought that this melody would mean so much to my life and so much to so many people in the world. So I just hum it anytime I feel like humming something. And so Christmas Eve in 1965, I was invited to the Elks Club to do a private party. Just so happened, Quinn Ivey, he was the number one disc jockey around there. He was invited, too. And so I just made up this lyrics of Why Did You Leave Me, Baby? And used that melody that I had been singing for years when I was growing up as a kid. And he loved it. He said, what feeling, you know. But he said, Percy, all you need is to write some strong lyrics with this feeling and this melody, and I think you'll have your hit record.
297-5633 if you'd like to engage the great Percy Sledge, who is still performing, and we'll find out what's going on with him right now, and he lives right here in our midst. The legend has it that the song's inspiration, When a Man Loves a Woman, came when your girlfriend left you for a modeling career after you were fired from a construction job in the midst.
Well, that was false.
That's not true.
That was false.
It's a good story.
Yeah. I wasn't fired from construction. I was laid off.
Okay. All right.
And the girl that I was dating never left me for somebody else. It was a story told that she had left with somebody else, but she hadn't. But she didn't go to California nowhere for no Marlin job. She went to New Jersey to work.
New Jersey. What was her name?
Her name was King, Liz King. But I don't talk about that anymore, Jim, because I'm happily married now. You know?
That was a long time ago. But she was the inspiration for one of the great songs of all time. Certainly a big part of your life.
Well, you know, if it hadn't have been for her back in during that time, I would have never sung the song.
Mm-hmm. You can hear the pain, some joy, a lot of emotions in that song.
Well, when a man loves a woman, you know, he sleep out in the rain. All she got to do is say that's the way it's got to be.
Well, I've never heard the Barbara Mandrell recording. She must have recorded as When a Woman Loves a Man, right?
Yeah, Barbara Mandrell, I met her in Nashville. George Jones was the one who introduced me to her.
Yeah?
I had been wanting to meet Barbara for years and years. I met everybody in the country world but except her. So George went and brought her to my dressing room. Me and George were sharing the same dressing room at that big thing they had in Nashville. It was a roast.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a listener who wants to know if you knew Bobby Bland.
Now, me and Bobby were real good friends. I was just a little boy under him and B.B. King. And I remember years ago when I first come out with When a Man Loves a Woman, they used to sit me down and talk to him and give me advice, him and B.B. both. And I was on the same show with them. I never in my life thought that I'd ever be on the same stage with Bobby Blue Bland and B.B. King. But they were really great guys.
And, of course, we lost Bobby Bland a few days ago.
Yes, we did, yeah.
A couple of years ago, you recorded some music with Cliff Richard.
Yeah, me and Cliff is good buddies. I finally met him. I heard so much talk about him, you know, and from other artists. And so he finally invited me to come to England and do a tour with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be really great because we did a couple of duets together, and it was a great tour, one of my greatest tours.
That song, Percy, When a Man Loves a Woman, it not only was a top hit in the United States, it was huge in Europe,
yeah. And
even in South Africa.
Yeah, I just left South Africa about 2 weeks ago.
Really? How was that?
Fantastic, because I hadn't been in a long time, and the people have been waiting for me for many years, you know. So it turned out it's like it was when I left, on the biggest crowds they ever had, you know.
You still enjoy performing, don't you?
I love it. Jim, it's part of my life. It's in my blood, you know. And my fans is what really keep me going because they always meet me with smiles and happy to see me. And they give me that strength, you know, to keep singing.
For a man who could live anywhere you want and any style you wish, why Baton Rouge? Why do you live here?
That's where I met my wife.
Yeah?
Yeah, I had a manager up in Monroe by the name of Smitty Smith during those years when I met Rosa. And he owned so many nightclubs in Louisiana and Mississippi. And he was booking me in shows in his nightclub. And so I saw Rosa going down to Morgan City. She lived in Morgan City, and I had my driver to pull her off the road. And she thought that we was trying to rob him or something, you know. But I told her that I liked the way she looks.
You just saw her on the road?
Yeah, we pulled off. My driver pulled off the road.
Really?
Yeah. And then we start talking, start dating. Next thing you know, hey, there we go.
Which highway was this?
That's going on Morgan City.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And some places you might get charged with stalking for something like that.
You know what? That's what Rosen there was saying. They were scared. They didn't know what we was going to do because a black guy riding a car with two white guys, he said, they didn't know where to run or do what, you know, because
yeah.
Smitty Smith's son was the one that was working with me at that time.
Did she have any idea who you were?
No, I put my picture up to the window, and
she
never seen it before.
Just thought you were some nut.
But she had heard the song, but she didn't know. She never saw Percy Sledge before.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm amazed she didn't accelerate and try to get away from you.
Well, you know what she did? She was really frightened, you know. She was scared. And her sister was with her.
Mm-hmm.
So she looked around her sister's because her sister was driving. She was on the other side. And her smile was much brighter and better than her sister's was. So.
Sure, her sister's glad to hear that. Was this in the daytime?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I had a concert to do in Morgan City, and see Rosa was on her way home for the weekend because her family, her mom and dad, lived in Morgan City, but she was living in Baton Rouge herself at that time.
Rosa Sledge. She's a beautiful Rosa woman, Sledge. Right? Beautiful. Percy Sledge, you're inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2005 in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. That must have been quite an experience.
It was really quite an experience, Jim. I had been so many places in the world and received so many awards, and I think that was the greatest one of them all. And one of my best friends presented the trophy to me, and that was Rod Stewart, you know, one of my favorite.
Yeah.
Been knowing his songs and him for many years. And for him to come all the way from England to present the trophy to me, that was another big step.
Is he recorded When a Man Loves a Woman?
No, you know, I'm surprised at that, you know. It's a one, if he did, I don't know anything about it, but he might have it in a can somewhere in the studio. Because, hey, Rod Stewart, man, he sang so much, you know, many songs. You know.
Who were you inducted with?
We had U2 and Buddy Guy, Louisiana Buddy Guy.
Yeah, I know. But been on the show.
And the OJs.
And Backstabbers.
Somebody else, I can't think of the name, but it was a European songwriter, I believe it was.
Okay, well, that is the highest honor you can get, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, Jim, you know, it's a feeling. When Rod presented that trophy to me, it looked like something just went all through me. I had received many trophies all over the world, many different countries, but this one here was just something, vibration, you know, it was just... Looked like I could see all the places that I've been and sung my songs, and rain and snow and mosquitoes.
Who are your favorite singers?
Well, you take, I was raised up in the country, so I was raised up in country music, and Hank Williams and Jim Reeve and people like that was my favorite singer when I was
really?
A kid. But after I got to be a teenager in high school, and people like Jimmy Hughes, my cousin, he was one of my favorite singers. He was born and raised in Leeton. Mm-hmm. And then I can go on to the big guys that you probably know, like Otis Redding. And,
yeah.
And
He did When a Man Loves a Woman.
Yeah. Yeah, Otis.
Do you like the Motown sound?
Yeah, Motown was one of my favorite, too, because there's so many great singers there, like Marvin Gaye and Temptation, Four Tops, and people like that. Mm-hmm. And I worked with most of all of them one time or the other.
Well, Percy Sledge, you've been around the world and back, and you still call Baton Rouge home. You lived here how long now?
I love Baton Rouge.
You've lived here how long?
Oh, let's see, 38 years.
38 years. Came here in the mid-70s, about a decade after When a Man Loves a Woman. What are you up to right now?
Well, now I'm fixing to... I got a couple of shows coming up this week. I mean, in July, I'll be playing Opelousas, the casino there. And me and Buddy Guy have a big concert that we're going to be doing in Jackson, Mississippi on the 19th of July.
And 19th of July.
And then
that's
I got
one
a
to see. Buddy Guy and Percy Sledge in the same place at the same time.
And believe
time.
It or not, Jim, this will be the first time we ever worked together, of course.
Wow.
We've been around each other quite a bit, but this will be the first time we worked together.
July 19th, mark the date.
Yep.
In Jackson, Mississippi.
Jackson, Mississippi.
That concert should have been in Baton Rouge.
Well, you know what? We're working on it. I'm looking forward to coming with me and him to Baton Rouge.
Well, let's have you back soon.
Well, Jim, I'm going to tell you, I really enjoy being here, man.
Well,
it was so nice to meet you, even though it was at a sad time. I was one of my best friends had passed away, you know. And he's missed already so much.
You're talking about Jerry Lane.
Jerry Lane, yeah.
Yeah, he and you were quite close, weren't you?
Very close. Yeah. He used to invite me up to his office. We'd sit up there for hours talking. He showed me all his trophies and stuff when he was growing up, coming up as a young man. I mean, we were very close. And his son, we are close.
Eric.
Yeah. We both baseball freaks. We love baseball. and we could talk for hours on baseball.
UCLA won the national title last night in the College World Series. Who do you like in the majors? Who's your major league?
Cincinnati Reds.
Cincinnati Reds.
Since I was 12 years old.
Jeez. You remember Frank Robinson.
Oh, go way back to Wally Post, Big Kazuski, all of them.
Yeah. And, of course, Pete Rose, Johnny
Bench. And Pete. Now, that's when we were really whooping butts at that time. The big red machine.
Well, thank you, Percy.
Jim, it's a
appreciate
pleasure.
The visit, and let's do it again.
Yeah, sure. I'm looking forward to it, Jim.
So am I. We're joined now by a gentleman who has made national news, a Pentecostal preacher from Louisiana who has switched gears in a huge way. He is now an avowed atheist. Jerry DeWitt's ministry began when he was 17, and after 25 years of preaching in DeRidder, including the pastorship of two fundamentalist congregations, he decided that he's a non-believer. He's joining us from New York City, appropriately from Hell's Kitchen. Good morning,
Good
Jerry
morning.
DeWitt. Jerry
Good
DeWitt,
morning,
the book is Hope After Faith. You're a brave man. We still live in a society that largely in the United States, at least people give lip service to believing in God, and most are Christians. What happened to you?
Well, first off, thank you for allowing me to be on, and I'm absolutely humbled to be following Percy Sledge. I don't even know what to say. That's so beautiful. For me, it was really, and I know this may sound somewhat insulting to some believers, I think I just took it all very seriously, and I tried to investigate the doctrine as wholeheartedly as I could, and after 25 years of study, I feel like I graduated from my faith.
What started for you as far as being a Pentecostal person and later a minister at a Jimmy Swaggart camp, didn't it?
Yes. Oh, my gracious. But, you know, Baton Rouge and of course, Louisiana just is able to absolutely move the world, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's always a Baton Rouge angle, and Jimmy Swaggart is still the foremost televangelist in the world in 104 countries now,
yes.
And people now would probably see him on the street and not know who he is. He's 78 years old, but when did you encounter Brother Jimmy?
Well, my personal encounter was at age 17, but my mom and dad, you know, they had a television. It was my grandparents who were Pentecostal that did not have televisions and really lived the Pentecostal lifestyle, so my mom and stepdad, that is, you know, passing through on Sunday mornings, I cannot tell you how many hundreds of times I saw Jimmy Swaggart on television and felt the pull, just felt the pull. And so when I went there in person at age 16 and 17, you know, I totally got pulled into the message. I really thought what he was preaching was what the world needed, and I was completely captivated by the idea of making the world a better place and saving all of these souls. It was, it honestly was, for lack of better words, very magical.
What do you think that pull was?
You know, I think it was a lot of things. I think
all
there
right, hold
were...
tight. We've got to take a break, and we'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Jerry DeWitt, a former Pentecostal preacher from DeRidder. His book is Hope After Faith, gaining nationwide attention. He has gone from the voyage of being a man of great faith to a man who is a non-believer. And he's doing so, of course, in a state that is largely Christian and, in some estimations, deeply religious. Now, we hit the break, and you were talking about this experience you had at a Jimmy Swaggart camp as a young man, and you said you felt a pull, and I asked you what that pull was, and we had to pause, but what was going on then? Was it Swaggart's magnetism, or was there something else going on there?
I think it was a combination. I was 16, 17 years of age, and so there were a lot of needs that I had in my life. I was looking for direction, and what I now know is I was very much already a humanist. I was very concerned with human suffering. Of course, now I fulfill those needs through the Foundation Beyond Belief and the Clergy Project and such. But also, at the same time, here's a 16-year-old kid walks into really one of the greatest shows that you could imagine at that time. The showmanship was just stellar and completely captivating. And when I saw what I believed at the time to be the moving of the Holy Spirit, there was no doubt in my mind that God was real, the Holy Spirit was real, and that not only that Jesus loved me and had died for my sins, but that Jesus was speaking to me personally.
And all that went away. Did it happen
over 25 years?
Well, was there a catalyst of some kind?
Yes, actually there is. You know, not long after my experience at Swaggart's, I felt called to the ministry. I would have dreams. Almost every single night I would dream that I was preaching messages, and when I would read the Bible, I would hear messages. Over the next several years, I would see visions. I would see what I thought were miracles. I would hear what I believed to be the voice of God. But as I took on the responsibility of ministry, I felt obligated to get to the bottom of every matter that I would preach on. And the real catalyst was this idea of hell and eternal punishment.
Jerry DeWitt, Hope After Faith is his book. He was recently featured in the New York Times Magazine. And the story that was published in the New York Times talked about an experience in May of 2011. You're in bed in DeRidder, and their phone rings. What happens?
Yeah, so someone very near and dear to our family, a former church member, calls. Her brother had been in a horrible accident. And so I take the call, and it's obvious to me immediately that she is looking for me to pray for her and with her. And unbeknownst to me, I wasn't going to be able to pray. When I answered the phone, it never even crossed my mind. But as I realized that's what she was needing, I also realized that to pray for her would be like telling the biggest lie that I had ever told, and it would be it would also be misleading her. And at that moment, I had already known that I was not believing, and I had already known that I was struggling with a lot of other issues theologically in my life, but I always hoped that I could somehow stay in the ministry because that was what I loved to do and who I thought I was. When I realized I couldn't pray for her, I realized there was no hope of staying in the ministry.
Now, word has it that you're planning to open a church, an atheist church, not far from where I am right now. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, that's exactly right. Community Mission Chapel. Yeah, I'm hard-headed, my friend. I refuse to get out of the ministry. Even though I'm completely secular and our congregation will be completely secular, I still know that our Louisiana culture has something very specific, not only to offer the world, but to offer people's individual lives. And so I think we can do that through a secular ministry, for lack of better terminologies.
Now that you've had this epiphany, Jerry, do you have contempt for those who have these strong religious beliefs?
No, not at all, not even in the least. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm a human being like everyone else. When somebody, you know, writes something ugly about me on Facebook, you know, it ticks me off like it would anyone. But I quickly get over it, and, you know, to condemn them would be to condemn myself of just a couple of years back. And no, I love them very much, and I understand that life is hard, life is difficult, and we're all looking for ways to deal with it and to go through it. So I love them, and my plan is just to love them so hard they have to love me back.
Now, as I said, we're in a state that at least gives lip service to religion, and in Louisiana and in the United States profess to be Christians, but now, maybe one in five people have no religious affiliation, and some actually say outright that they are atheists. And we've had them on this show, many smart people, much smarter than I, who don't believe. One of those who was on this show not so long ago, and at the very least is an agnostic, perhaps an atheist, is Edwin Edwards, who was elected governor of Louisiana four times.
Right.
Jerry, do you think there are more people like Edwin Edwards than we know?
Yes. I think there are more, at least, agnostics than what we know. I think there are a lot of agnostics sitting in church pews because it's part of our culture. And to make a public statement that you don't really believe everything that people think you should believe, you run the risk of losing family, friends, finance, your favor within the community. And so it's a great challenge. It is a huge challenge to admit something like that publicly. So there's no doubt in my mind there's many, many, many more of us. And actually, I think the numbers are growing every day thanks to the power of the Internet and our access to information.
297-5633 is your number locally, outside 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org. For Jerry DeWitt, the author of Hope After Faith. June writes about your involvement with the Clergy Project. What is this?
Yeah, the Clergy Project is an online forum. It's anonymous, and it's a place for ministers who no longer believe in the supernaturalism of their doctrine to come and to find help. It's a place where people who already know, ministers who already know that they're agnostic or atheist, to find emotional support and hopefully find some help in getting out of the ministry if that's what they're looking at doing.
Well, do you feel any lesser confident of mankind now that you're an atheist? Do you have concerns that there's no higher power to stop us from obliterating ourselves?
Well, you know, that's a very fair question, and I would have had an extremely positive answer at the beginning, but once you added the second part, I do know that we're in dangerous times, obviously, just because of, the advancement of technology and the political landscape makes things very dangerous for us. I understand that, but I feel like that my experience within the secular movement has done nothing but boost my confidence in humanity. I had been taught from an early age that man was so wicked that the only cure was basically to trash the earth and start over. And I no longer feel that way. You know, there's no doubt that I've got people who don't like me. I've got people who are very critical. But that doesn't in any way affect my attitude towards humanity.
Jerry, as a Pentecostalist, Pentecostal minister and congregant, you must have spoken in tongues at one point.
Oh, not just one point. You probably all added it up together. It was probably for a full year.
Well, what was going on? Were you uttering gibberish, or was something going on? You were?
Yes. Yes. To be straight about it, yes. Technically, I was uttering gibberish. That sounds blunt and hard, and I definitely do not mean to be offensive to any of my Pentecostal friends, but obviously I didn't think so. And I was very sincere about it. It's a psychological phenomenon that's very well researched. It happens in a lot of different types of religion and obviously in other Christian denominations besides Pentecostalism. So it's a human phenomenon. And, it's done with great sincerity. And it has some psychological benefit, much like meditation. So I'm not here to knock it in any way other than I would love for any 16- or 17-year-old Pentecostal who's about to make life-changing decisions like I did to just maybe Google speaking in other tongues and make sure that really is God talking to them and through them before they make those choices.
297-5633, Gray in Catahoula. Gray, you're on the air with Pastor Jerry DeWitt.
All right, thank you, Jim. And Jerry, I just wondered, maybe I missed it, but I didn't quite understand why Jerry decided to become an atheist and to give up belief. And I wondered if it had anything to do with such things as the fact that we know now that there are something like 200 billion galaxies in the known universe, or what it was that led him away from religion.
Yeah. That's a great question. I appreciate it. First, let me clarify one thing, is that a person doesn't choose to be an atheist or choose to leave their faith or lose their faith, which is common terminology. A person realizes that they're an atheist or an agnostic. They realize that they simply don't believe, because belief is something that's somewhat automatic down in the psyche. And so I never made that kind of choice. I came to the realization that that's where I was at. The science and the beauty and wonder of the world that science has now exposed me to, it really just came along and supported what I was beginning to suppose was true, which was that that my religion was really a mythology, just like so many other religions. But there was no one single moment. It was layer by layer of unraveling theology first and then experience second.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court has just in the last few minutes issued a decision about the Defense of Marriage Act, declaring it unconstitutional. Do you think the religious community will react with zeal in opposition to this decision?
Sure. I think the religious, the segment of the religious community that takes the Bible literally is forced to stand against homosexuality because the Bible is against homosexuality. You know, what's fascinating about the human species is that we can take some things seriously and some things not seriously at all. And people do that with the Bible. People cherry-pick the parts that, you know, fit them or their denomination or their social group more perfectly. And I truly don't mean to say that in a way that sounds like I'm being mean or hateful. That's just part of being a human being. So, yes, I would suspect that they'll not be happy.
The vote was 5-4 today, shutting down the Defense of Marriage Act signed by Bill Clinton in 1996, preventing same-sex couples whose marriages are recognized from their home state from receiving benefits available to other married couples under federal law. This is a huge decision from the high court. We're living in an evolving, not only is your life evolving, Jerry, we're living in an evolving society.
That's correct. I really feel like that my life is nothing but just another example of how our society is evolving. And that's really what the secular movement is all about, is trying to express that there are other ways of living and that these ways of living, they come from the heart. They're who we really are. They're not choices that we're making in order to be controversial or to try and cause society trouble. We're just expressing our true identity. So this could be seen by, you know, when historians look back as a troubling time, but I hope that it's actually the birth of the nation that we always planned on having.
HB in Denham Springs, you're on the air, HB, with Jerry DeWitt. Hi, HB.
Good morning. Just a quick question, not knocking you or anything like that, but how does an atheist explain that has happened in our world and just our lifetimes that is unexplainable by logic or science and attributed to divine intervention?
All right.
That's a good question, HB. Can you give me an example?
Well, we've lost it, but obviously there are those who believe that the creation is so intricate that it couldn't have happened through evolution or any other source other than a higher power having a divine hand. Do you understand that?
Yeah, sure. I can completely understand where they're coming from because I was there. Obviously, there are wonderful, wonderful books and, you know, hundreds of thousands of YouTube videos, I would suspect, that could explain it all very well. I think the main problem that we have is that we're all working with brains that are very limited in understanding large scopes of time. Whenever you truly begin to grasp just how much time evolution and natural selection has had to make the differences that we now see, it does become much clearer and much easier to understand.
Hal asks about Christopher Hitchens, who died a few years ago. You quote him in your book. He caught a lot of heat from being an atheist. Do you think he died a happy man?
Well, do I think he died a happy man? I think he lived true to himself. You know, I'm at the point at the moment that I think happiness probably has more to do with biology than it does to do with anything else, because there's obviously happy atheists, there's also happy believers, and then there's people on both sides who aren't very happy at all. Sometimes my happiness is just dependent upon, you know, my blood sugar level. But I think he died a man who could be proud of himself, and I think he died a man who was proud of what he stood for, and he died an honest man.
How's your family reacted to you, Jerry, for making this?
You know, it really just depends. A whole lot of them don't talk to me anymore. I've got a very large family in the area where I live. Most of them are not interested in associations. Some of them actually come on Facebook and, you know, remind me that I'm going to hell.
All right. Doc in St. Francisville, please be brief. You're on with Jerry. Hi, Doc. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay. Got a question about the vote this morning, the Defense of Marriage Act. Does that mean I can go to Utah now and get me 5 or 6 women?
All right. That's the kind of thought that will be expressed, I'm sure, by more people other than Doc.
I wasn't able to hear.
He said, does that mean he can go to Utah and now marry 5 or 6 women?
I wouldn't recommend.
There's a joker in every deck, right?
Exactly. That's
okay.
Right.
Thank you, Jerry DeWitt, and congratulations on certainly a provocative book, Hope After Faith, an ex-pastor's journey from belief to atheism. We look forward to seeing you in Baton Rouge at your new church for atheists.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Take care.
You.
Thank you, Jerry. Bye-bye. That's it for today. Follow the Supreme Court on WRKF throughout today. We'll be back tomorrow. For JC, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.